Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
Remember that sitcom The Office? Steve Carell played the boss, Michael Scott, as a guy who thought people loved his jokes.
If I had a gun with two bullets and I was in a room with Hitler, Bin Laden, and Toby, I would shoot Toby twice.
No.
Okay,
you were
all
being
right.
Really funny, and then you went too far.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Okay, Michael Scott's attempts at humor confirmed for everybody around him that he was a buffoon. The thing is, he wasn't wrong that a sense of humor can be a great asset to a career. He just never got it right. T. Bradford Bitterly is a doctoral candidate at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's co-author of a paper published recently in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. It's called Risky Business: When Humor Increases and Decreases Status. You can find a link to it at think.kera.org. Brad, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So humor can be associated with status in the workplace. First of all, why do high-status people tend to benefit from that in their careers?
So what we've been looking at is that we find that when someone tells a joke, they indicate to us that they're very confident. And when someone uses humor successfully, meaning when they can get other people to laugh, they also signal to us that they're more intelligent and more capable. The reason this is tied to status is that we want people that are the heads of our groups to be those that are the most capable of leading the group. And as a result, people who are funny indicate to us that they're more competent, and this is the mechanism that leads to higher status.
It feels a little strange to deconstruct all of this because humor, you know, the best humor tends to feel pretty off the cuff. But it plays a role in social interactions, right? It brings groups together.
Yeah, absolutely. It has tons of functions. It really pervades our daily interactions. And we even see when people are asked what traits they look for in their spouse and in their partner, they list sense of humor as one of the top traits that they're looking for. Yet in the prior organizational literature, humor has been largely ignored. And this was something that was really surprising to us. And that's why we were really interested in researching it.
Do you think it's because we have this idea that we should be very serious at work?
I think that's part of it. Absolutely. Something we were concerned about when we started this research is that as soon as people hear that you're doing research on humor, their first instinct is that they take it less seriously to begin with. So, like, we've been trying to really hammer home that even though this is about jokes and even though it's about humor, it's a really serious topic that has really profound consequences on how we think about each other and how we interact with one another.
So when we work in a team, this is really interesting, the use of humor is associated with better communication and also with the generation of more creative ideas.
Yeah, there's been prior studies that have found that humor patterns meaning that either a joke followed by another joke or a joke followed by laughter, that is correlated with more supportive statements among team members and also more constructive communication. And then when they followed up with these teams and measured performance, both immediately after the meetings and then 2 years later, they found that those teams with the greater incidence of humor patterns tended to be more productive as well.
This seems like a really complicated thing to study in a lab setting. Will you tell us a little bit about how your team designed different experiments to evaluate how well humor worked and for whom?
That definitely was a huge hurdle. So one of the designs that we use is we had participants go into the lab and we told them that they'd be doing a marketing study, and we gave them time to write a customer testimonial for a hypothetical product. And then we told them that each of them would be presenting in a randomly determined fashion. Now, really, the first two presenters were Confederates. They're research assistants who we told them specifically what to say. Mm-hmm. And we always had the first presenter give a serious testimonial. And then with the second presenter is where we did our manipulation. We had them either deliver a serious testimonial or a humorous one. But getting that design right, getting it so that way people actually weren't suspicious of the research assistants, all those factors definitely took a long time to figure out.
Yeah, because you have to be subtle enough, right?
Exactly, yeah. And we want to make sure that, to your point, that a lot of humor is off the cuff in the moment. We really wanted it to come off like that. We didn't want people to think that these were scripted responses, that these were just research assistants that we selected, that were just delivering testimonials that we had created before.
So did you have like an audition process for the research assistants that would be playing the people in this study?
It wasn't a huge yeah, audition process with like a casting department or anything like that. Yeah, we didn't, yeah, there wasn't like a camera and we were sitting there. It was something when we were hiring research assistants that we wanted to check with, that it was something that they were comfortable with doing. Because, yeah, a big fear of ours was that the research assistants would feel really uncomfortable. Getting up there and acting out a scripted response isn't something that everyone would feel comfortable with.
What kinds of jokes? There are caveats here, and so that's what we're going to get to now. What kinds of jokes are perceived to be inappropriate at work?
All the conditions for inappropriateness, that's definitely an area of research that we want to pursue going forward. One that we researched in our paper was sexually inappropriate jokes, because that was one where we pilot tested the jokes that we used. So that was another hurdle to in researching this. We wanted to make sure that the jokes we were going to use were funny and then also varied in appropriateness. And saying a sexually inappropriate joke was one that it was just very clear to begin with would be inappropriate for an interview setting. For example, we had one situation where a manager asks a job candidate, "Are you looking for a challenging position?" And the candidate either says, "Yes, I'm a hard worker and like challenges," or the candidate says, "That's what she said."
Oh, goodness.
So there is a context where, yeah, making a joke like that is just clearly inappropriate.
Okay, so this is really interesting. Making a joke, even an inappropriate joke, can make you seem confident, but making a joke that is inappropriate can make you seem less than competent.
Yes, exactly. And this is one thing that we found really interesting about this work, because in a lot of the prior status research, they found that behaviors that signal high confidence typically increase status. And the reason that that happens is that we tend to associate confidence with higher competence. But with inappropriate jokes, what we find is that we give the person who says the inappropriate joke points for being really confident. We can think of, say, Michael Scott from The Office. Or Larry David on Curb Your Enthusiasm, like the character he's playing in that. We think that those people are really confident, but you get such a strong signal of lower competence. Like, you see the things that they say and you think, "I can't believe they said that. What an idiot." And that overpowers any benefits that you'd get from confidence, and those people lose status.
What's so interesting about that, Brad, is that that's separate and apart from how well they actually do on the job. So we might know that, you know, Sally's a great lawyer, but if she's telling inappropriate jokes, we don't think she's such a great lawyer.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. What we were just looking at was initial perceptions of these joke tellers. We didn't provide people with any additional information about how competent these people actually were. So you're right. You could have someone that's saying inappropriate jokes, they're losing status, and they're getting written off during the interview process. All the while, they could be remarkably competent and actually really highly intelligent, but they don't get the opportunity to show that.
What happens if what you call a humor attempt just isn't inappropriate but falls flat? Like, does it hurt our status if we tell a joke and nobody laughs?
We didn't find that it hurt so much. And part of the reason for that is that you're still indicating that you're confident. And provided that the joke is appropriate, it's really not harming that much. It's not sending this strong signal that this person isn't aware of social boundaries or is extremely offensive. So if someone says, like, a pun that doesn't land, yeah, we're not going to think, "Oh my gosh, that person is really witty," but we're also probably not going to say, like, "I never want to work with that person." So
do most people have a pretty good sense of whether they're doing humor right? You know what I mean? Like, how aware are inappropriate joke tellers that they're pushing the boundaries of what's acceptable?
So people in general, there's been some work on this, and people in general really don't have a good read on predicting what other people would view as funny. Mike Yeomans at Harvard actually did a really interesting study where he recruited participants, and he recruited them in pairs. And what he found was that algorithms were more accurate at predicting how funny someone would view a joke than even the person's spouse. So it's pretty incredible. So we tend to be really overconfident in our ability to predict what other people are going to view as funny. And I think this is what can really get everyone in hot water sometimes. Like, you see people on Twitter just sending out a joke that they think is really funny, isn't going to have huge consequences, and that's the tweet that just blows up their career.
Yeah, I mean, you write about this young woman who she got on a plane, made what everyone agrees to be an inappropriate joke. Her intention was not as sinister as what the way the joke came across to people, but it didn't matter.
No, it didn't. And it's a really fascinating case. Yeah, it was Justine Seiko. As you said, she was taking a flight. She was going to South Africa for the winter holiday. And while she had a layover in Heathrow, she tweeted out, "Going to South Africa, hope I don't get AIDS. Just kidding, I'm white." And while she was on her flight from London to Cape Town, the tweet just went viral. And there were actually protesters waiting for her by the time her plane touched down. And what was really interesting is reading follow-up interviews with her, she actually said, like, she thought that it was more of a parody comment and that there was absolutely no way that anyone could actually take that as a serious comment. If anything, what she meant to make fun of is the type of person who would genuinely make that comment. But the danger with things like social media and Twitter is that you don't know all of your audience, and all of your audience doesn't know you. So once it's out there, you lose control over it. And yeah, by the time she realized that a lot of people viewed it as inappropriate, it was already too late.
Reading this study, I was thinking about somebody writing one of those, you know, very quick business books, instructing people on using humor in the workplace to increase their status. I wonder if it's a good idea to try this if humor doesn't come naturally.
I think people can actually practice a lot more than they think they can. So one thing we've been discussing is that in preparation for interviews, people work on predicting the questions that they're going to be asked, and they can usually do so with like a pretty high degree of reliability. You know, like, oh, you're going to be asked things like, what are your greatest strengths? What are your greatest weaknesses? Something you can do is, just as you practice your normal responses, you could actually practice your jokes as well and run them by family members and friends and get feedback and then practice the delivery. So that way, going into it, you have a pretty strong sense of whether or not it's a good joke and whether or not people are going to laugh.
Have you studied the effects of how we respond to other people's humor attempts? Like, does it affect our status to laugh or not laugh when the boss makes a joke?
We haven't looked at that. We're really interested in actually looking at that. The impact of either laughing or withholding laughter after a joke's been made. Now, about with regards to laughter and status, Chris Ovase at University of California, San Diego, has done really interesting work on how we can actually infer status from laughter. So you can actually tell by how dominantly someone's laughing whether or not they're a high or low status individual.
What's dominant laughter? What does that sound like?
So I think it's, I didn't hear the clips that they use, but they use the example of, it's kind of like whether or not you're laughing. The gist appears to be whether or not you're more laughing at someone or laughing with them. Huh. In that study, what they did was they recruited fraternity members and had either a senior or junior member of the fraternity, and then recorded and found that you could tell by, yeah, the way that the one individual was laughing in response to what the other person had said, you could actually piece together who was actually the senior member of the fraternity and who was the junior member.
Brad, this has been really interesting. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was awesome.
T. Bradford Bitterly is a doctoral candidate at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's co-author of a paper published recently in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. It's called Risky Business: When Humor Increases and Decreases Status. Up next, we talk with Rob Walker, who writes the workplace advice column The Workologist for the New York Times. Stay with us.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the summer of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. In the first part of the show, we talked about the risky business of jokes in the workplace, when they help our careers and when they hurt. Now we turn to a man who has spent years advising people in all kinds of careers about their work-related dilemmas, from how much to trust HR folks with confidential information, to calling out coworkers' fake sick days, to knowing when it's time to jump ship. Rob Walker writes the Workologist column for the New York Times, and surprisingly, he says the only thing that stresses him out about listening to other people's complaints is when he doesn't have enough challenging problems to advise them on. So we figured he could give us a sense of the kinds of work conflicts that are common to many industries and maybe answer some of your questions in the process. Rob, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan.
How often are workplace challenges about the fact that work requires us to deal with other human beings?
Oh, well, I mean, it's all that. And, you know, and that, in fairness, you know, the workplace, a lot of us spend, you know, most of our waking hours in the workplace, and the people that we're around are not people that we made any conscious decision to be around. And we've got to figure out how to negotiate that. So inevitably, there's going to be a lot of opportunity for things to go sideways, all kinds of ways, and I've pretty much heard, well, I haven't heard them all. I've heard a lot of them.
I remember being really stunned in my first real job after college that it wasn't all that different from school, which is to say there were cliques, there were the strivers and the excuse makers, and nothing bonded peers quite as effectively as shared frustration with the people in positions of authority.
Yeah, much to the frustration of managers everywhere, I'm sure. You know, in some ways, that's the column. The premise in some ways is to be an outlet for that, to give you, I mean, we basically built the column around the idea that you don't necessarily need to get advice. I mean, this is going to sound like, why am I even on the show? But you don't need you don't need advice from a real expert. You just need advice from someone who's dispassionate about it and can exercise some common sense and isn't involved in whatever clique situation or whatever grudges or whatever, you know, version of events that you and your immediate sympathizers are involved in. So because a lot of these things, you know, they are sort of commonsensical, and anyone writing me with the problem would probably be really good at advising someone else on a very similar problem. But it's really hard to do that when we're talking about ourselves and, you know, for the reasons I was saying earlier, it is so much of our life and it gets very emotional and very, irrational, let's say.
You know, you talked about the time and energy that we spend at work. A lot of us spend more waking hours with, you know, workmates than with family members. What are the pros and cons of thinking of our colleagues as friends?
Oh, well, I have a bias about this that it comes partly from your show, because I heard you had a guest on that I later used in the column, Amy Cooper Hakeem.
Right, yeah.
Who, you know, she makes a case that I've tried to make before, but she made it a lot more strongly about, you know, we do often come into these situations thinking that we need to be really close friends with everybody and that we need to socialize after work, and that makes for a happy workplace environment. And it's really setting yourself up for a lot of problems if you approach it that way. What you really want to do is peacefully coexist, not be miserable, not be making anyone miserable, get your work done, and then have your own life. If you, you know, a true friend at work is great. But it's not something that it's a very high bar to set to sort of think of, and maybe this is where it differs from school, or although maybe you're in a much happier workplace than most of my readers. But but unlike school, you know, you can sort of find your clique and everything will be fine, and social life is a big part of it. That's not really how it works at work.
Under what circumstances should we go to a supervisor about social issues with peers at work? When somebody is, you know, making us miserable, but we can't really point to anything that's affecting our job responsibilities?
Well, that's really important, actually, is that because I tell everyone to, you've got to figure out a way to frame it around maybe not your job responsibilities, but around the effect on the enterprise in general. And it's a thought exercise on one level to sort of step back and say, you know, what difference does this really make? And it might help you, you know, learn to coexist with this person if you can kind of identify the things that are outside of your control but that don't really affect your job. But even if you decide, well, okay, this person, whatever, even if they're just someone who's loud all day or something, you know, some personal thing, as long as you can figure out a way to frame that, then that affects the enterprise and your productivity and the productivity and happiness of the people around you, then I think it's fine and appropriate to, you know, either have a blunt discussion with that person, not mean, and, you know, maybe if you can, per your last guest, do it with some humor. Or if you can't do it with that person, I think it's fine to take it up with a manager.
Do we automatically have an obligation to report colleagues who break the rules?
Ethically, you sort of do. I can understand situations where people don't, but it's sort of a, you know, do you want the right answer or do you want what is the easy answer? It kind of depends. I mean, it depends on how you, you don't want to sort of entangle yourself in a situation that's actually, you know, ambiguous in some ways, which I get a lot of questions that are, you know, I think this is wrong. And it's not quite as clear cut as they might believe. So you want to step with caution, but you know, ethically, you do want to feel like what you want to do is think out the situation of like, what happens when this person finally gets caught? Let's say, you know, that someone is stealing from the company and they finally get caught. And then it becomes out that you knew all along. Well, don't you wish you would have said something at the time,
right?
No matter how unpleasant it was. So you kind of have to game those things out, but you know, I don't want to sort of be suggest a sort of recklessness about it, because I do get so many queries from people who are, you know, I think maybe without knowing it, translating their dislike of someone into an accusation of malfeasance of that person.
Are there special issues that are starting to crop up among people who work remotely and have to kind of forge a relationship with someone that they might deal with on a regular basis but have never been in the same room with?
Yeah, it comes up from time to time. And, you know, the advice is pretty straightforward about it, which is that you do have to, if you work remotely, and I work remotely, you do have to make a little bit more of an effort to just kind of remind everyone that you exist and that you're working and that you're doing your thing. And the only thing I can really add to that is that I strongly advise people who are remote workers to try to make it a point on some regular basis to have an actual phone conversation with whoever your supervisor is. There's something about long-term relationships that happen only electronically where, you know, there's an ambiguity in electronic communication where you kind of, you know, talk about places where jokes might not work and things like that. And a friend of mine has a theory that if you don't, like, within 1 month, you'll hate each other if you don't. the magic of voice-to-voice communication is really powerful for doing that. And I think the best managers who manage remote employees know that and do that. But even if you don't have one of the best managers, and not everyone can have the best manager, then I encourage people to take it on themselves to do that.
You wrote recently about research that found 64% of people think they're being paid below market rates, which is obviously statistically impossible. Why do we tend to think that everybody else is getting a better deal?
Well, I mean, I don't actually think that's surprising. And you've had a lot of, I mean, you know a little bit about psychology and all that. And it's typical with everyone thinks they're better looking than the average. And everyone thinks that they drive better than average. Everyone thinks they do everything better than average. So, of course, they think that in this case, well, they're the victim and everyone else is making more money than me. And, you know, a big part of it is many companies are intentionally opaque about what they're being paid. So it's difficult to get good, hard information on this. So you start speculating and, you know, possibly other peers that you have might behave in ways where they are kind of trying to project the idea that they make more money than they really make. So you draw your own conclusions and you do it based on mostly guesswork. I think that research, that study, the underlying argument that they wanted to make was in favor of companies being more transparent about what the salaries are and who makes what, because they found that when they are more transparent, people are much more realistic in their salary demands.
That's interesting. Yeah, there are institutions, schools are probably a great example, where everybody knows what you're going to be making if you've been there a certain number of years.
Yeah.
Is it possible to rekindle a love for a particular job the way somebody might rekindle a relationship?
That's tough because it's actually not that hard, not that easy to rekindle a relationship, a romantic relationship. But You know, I think that if you, I'm not going to say it's impossible. I do recommend, you know, not surprisingly, I get a lot of questions from people who are burned out or they want to know if it's time to move on and this kind of thing. And I encourage people to, you know, always explore the marketplace. And when you do that, you know, keep in mind what it is that you're looking for and is there a way to get it from where you are? Because probably you're looking for some kind of change. And that's the key to rekindling that relationship is almost certainly going to be some kind of change, whether it's a change by you leaving or a change by you finding a new way to define the job at the organization where you are. Now, some organizations are more open to that than others. But, you know, going through that process of kind of looking around and playing the field, as it were, can help you clarify what it is you're looking for and therefore what it is that you might be able to ask for, whether it's a change in, I don't know, responsibility or opportunities to learn different skills or, you know, whatever it may be that's kind of underlying your sort of sense of being in a rut.
Do we know what we want when we go looking for a new job?
Well, too often what we want is to get out of the job that we're in. And another one of my sort of pillars of repeated wisdom on this is that I'm a big believer in sort of the permanent job search, not meaning that you spend your weekend cranking out hundreds of resumes, but that you are kind of always looking around, always trying to, you know, meet people. If you get a call, so many people who... they'll get a call from another, you know, maybe a recruiter or something like that, and they'll say, no, you know, that probably won't work out, and I won't do it. No, go have the lunch or whatever, you know. Find out what's out there. Worst case scenario is you have a little bit more information about what's going on around you. And then so you're much better off if you can make those moves kind of proactively rather than just waiting for this situation where you just want to get out, which is a roundabout way of getting at it, which you're getting at is that most of the time that's the most common reason that people seem to leave a job is not, or to take a new job is really not that they had a great killer new opportunity, but that they just were miserable where they were.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Rob Walker, who writes the Workologist column for the New York Times. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter @KERAThink. Job interviews feel so nerve-wracking, especially if we don't have a lot of experience with them. What do you say people, what kind of exercises can people go through before they actually find themselves in an interview so that they're not just, you know, sweaty-palmed and panicking at every question?
Yeah, well, the ultimate thing is going to be practice. And, you know, you can try to sort of role-play practice with a friend or a colleague or something like that. I think that that's actually more useful than you might think it would be, just because there's a big difference between kind of sitting around and thinking about what you might say or what you might be asked and doing any version of it in real time, even if you're not doing it with, say, an actual manager or something like that. But this also plays to the idea of that networking thing that I'm talking about, of the permanent job search, where, you know, if you go to have kind of a meeting with the recruiter or something like that, the informational interview, where there are no stakes at all, you don't really even want the job, you'll find that it loosens you up quite a bit. And you can experiment and learn about, well, that went over well, I'll remember that in the future, or I wasn't expecting that question, I'll remember that in the future. Some variation of that might come up. And, you know, worst case scenario, you totally blow it with this person, you lose nothing, and you've gained, one extra step of confidence.
Many people have had the experience of finding a job posting that sounds like it was written for them, and then they find they don't even get called for an interview. Are there ways to gain those online job sites where a computer is probably taking the first pass at our resumes so that some human being will at least look at our qualifications?
Yeah, it's an extremely controversial topic, those things, because tons of people are complaining about them all the time and want to know how to game the system. There are a couple of things. The most important, apparently, and this as sort of sad as this sounds, but the most important thing is that you revise your resume in such a way that it is literally whatever set of skills the job is advertising that they're looking for, you want to put like those exact words near the top of your resume, which sounds like a parody of something, but that's, I'm told that by multiple people in that business. But I'm also told that, you know, at the end of the day, all those computer things do is get you in the door, and I encourage people to also look for other ways in the door. Even if you're finding a perfect sounding job listing at, you know, Acme, whatever, you should also be thinking about, is there anybody I know who knows anybody at Acme, whatever, and can I worm my way in through the side and just get my resume in front of a human being, even if they're three steps removed, who might recognize that I am, in fact, the perfect person with the perfect set of skills. Because really those online resume, or those not online, but automated resume sorters are really designed, they're not designed to find the perfect person. They're designed to weed out the huge percentage of totally non-perfect people who are applying for everything. Because it's become kind of a proliferation game or something, where the more commonplace these things become, people think like, well, the best thing to do, it's so easy, I can send my resume to 500 jobs. Well, that means that each of those 500 jobs is probably now being overwhelmed with thousands and thousands of completely inappropriate resumes. And instead of spending all your time doing that and playing the volume game, you're much better off trying to zero in on the one or two places that really interest you. And that thing about trying to get in through the side and make a human contact there, even if that doesn't work for this specific job, you know, that's the kind of contact you want to be making and holding over time, so that maybe the next time something comes up, something will work out.
Rob Walker is my guest. He writes the Workologist column for the New York Times. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the summer of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Rob Walker, who writes the Workologist column for the New York Times. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. Rob, my children, who are just children, they're teenagers, assure me that this will never matter, but I've advised them to be careful about what lives on their social media pages, because at some point, a future employer might take a look at how they live their lives online. Should we really think about that? Does it matter? And for younger people, is it so ubiquitous to have a very open social media presence that at some point it will cease to matter?
Well, I don't know that those things are mutually exclusive. I think that right now it matters quite a bit, and you can pretty much count on an employer as a pretty routine practice, or a potential employer as a pretty routine practice, will at least Google you a little bit online. And I've had questions about this come up, and in fact, I have advised people that if you have something, say, that's beyond your control, I had someone who... They'd had a prior dispute at their, they'd ended up having a lawsuit with their prior employer, and they were in the right and they prevailed, but it was the first Google result that came up for them, which, as you can imagine, a potential employer might not be super excited to hear that your last job ended in a lawsuit, whether it was your fault or not. So, but you know, that's like sort of beyond your control, but you've got to be, A, you've got to be aware that stuff's out there. And B, you've got to do what you can to keep it under control and you know, understand the privacy settings on Facebook and things like this, so that you're not putting stuff on the open web. And I just advise people to count on anything you do on Facebook becoming public at some point, and that will help you not do anything too stupid. But then finally, if there is something that's beyond your control, it's probably better in an interview situation to just bring it up yourself and contextualize it yourself and take control of it. Because, you know, you kind of know they know.
Yeah.
They know you know they know. So seize control of the thing. Now, in the longer term, your kids may be right. You know, I mean, I can remember, you know, I'm old enough that, like, well, if you're a male with a pierced ear, you'll never get a decent job. Well, that didn't turn out to be true. So it's really hard to say what the mores will be 20 years from now. But I would advise today extreme caution. And it really is routine that they're checking whatever's available in the open web, and they might... You never know who's a friend of a friend on Facebook, and they can find things that way, and it happens all the time.
Yeah, you know, it is interesting. I've Googled people who, you know, might be working with us, but I would never think to drive by their house and see if they keep a tidy yard.
Right. Well, so again, changing social mores, and also it's just so easy. I think that from a personnel point of view, and I question the ethics of this in some ways, but I think the bottom line is it's just so easy that they can't resist. And so you can kind of argue about the abstract ethics of it and what it says about the way we live now and all that. But meanwhile, I would just count on the idea that it happens and act accordingly.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We have Marvin on the line in Grandview. Hi, Marvin.
Hi, Kristen. Bob? Hey, listen, I am in the medical field, and I have a certain manner of subject matter expertise, and I help the current facility I work at achieve a certain level of designation of a particular program. And now that that designation is done, I don't feel like I'm getting the support I need to continue to grow that program, i.e. an additional equipment and software. And so I feel like they felt like, oh, yes, we got the designation first time ever. That's good. But I can't seem to get past wanting to grow that program to something even better than it already is.
That's an interesting dilemma. What do you think, Rob?
Sure. Yeah, I think so. One of the another sort of recurring pillar or whatever is that you have to, a lot of the times when you have these kind of dilemmas, you have to approach things with a degree of empathy, right? And so you have to try to think through, well, what is their point of view likely on this? Why aren't they being supportive of it? And it's probably because they don't see what's the payoff. Why should they? You know, they've just exactly what you're saying. They've achieved their victory or their goal or their benefit from this. So that kind of shifts it back over to you a little bit to say, and you know, to paint the picture, to make the case for, like, you know, here's the big goal that we could shoot for next, and here's why it's in your interest for us to do that. And luckily you have me with all the appropriate skills and background and resources who can actually execute that unbelievable sounding dream. You know what I mean? Like, you kind of just have to position it where there's something in it for them. It's never managers, bosses, or whatever are very rarely convinced by, and I'm not saying that you're quite doing this, but that they're rarely convinced by the argument that, like, well, we need to pour more resources into this so that this person feels, you know, better about how they're spending their days.
What do you suggest to people who have been fired for cause? Like, maybe they intend to do the right thing in their very next position, but they've got to account for something pretty serious in their background.
Yeah, I think that's another thing that you just have to kind of own up to. And, you know, variation on what I was saying just now, like, think empathetically, think about how it's going to be perceived. Think about how to tamp down those kinds of responses. Be ready. And kind of own it and go into it with a situation of saying, well, look, I know that that this may be a potential red flag for you, whatever the situation was, but here's whatever, here's more context, here's how I've changed, here's how I can put you at ease about it. But what people tend to want to do in that situation is really just kind of grit their teeth and hope that no one finds out.
Probably not a great strategy.
Yeah. And, you know, also, like, in the job search, you probably, whatever situation you've been in, you probably have allies either at the company that you're leaving most immediately or from your past. And you want to try to lean on those people to be on your side to help you find situations where, you know, they can vouch for you if they're willing to do that.
All right. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Dick calling from Justin. Hi, Dick.
Hi. I don't suppose there's anything that could really be done with regard to age discrimination. When I was working as a mechanical engineer designing oil field equipment, we used to joke about becoming a greeter at one of the large box stores. Well, when oil prices went down and I got laid off at the age of 63, I no longer found that to be a joke, because many of the times I applied and either never heard anything back or were told simply that they were looking at other applicants. And most of these jobs, even the simplest ones, I know I have the education and physical capability to do the work, and yet nothing really comes of it. So the only thing I can assume is that either there's something terrible in my background that I don't know about, or I'm too old.
Hmm. Yeah, you're not alone feeling that way. I get, and I did a couple of columns about this a year or so ago, talking about this issue. There are no easy answers to it, in part because, you know, actual age discrimination is illegal, but sort of stealth age discrimination is almost impossible to prove. And I hate to push back. I mean, you know, I talk to a lot of real experts about this kind of thing, people who study this phenomenon on a more macro level than I do. And, there are some things that you can do in terms of basically how you're positioning yourself, and that is, making sure that you're projecting, willingness to learn new things, projecting all the things that counter all the unfair stereotypes of an older, quote-unquote older person. Sort of take them head on. And, you know, maybe be specific, like you've, learned some new computer program or something like that. So that's important. And and the other thing to keep in mind about it is that, and this is maybe a little bit counterintuitive, but one of the reasons I don't think that people count on or they have this problem is that if you're a younger hiring manager, you might actually be intimidated by someone who has more experience and smarts than you do. And sometimes, quote unquote, older workers project that. They project that, like, well, I'm certainly qualified for this job that I'm applying for, because frankly, I could do yours probably better than you. And they may be right about that, but if you're projecting it, even unconsciously, you're kind of perceived as a threat. And I don't think that that's a factor that people take into account very often. And I know it sounds counterintuitive when you're talking about something, you know, really entry-level-ish, but some hiring manager could be looking at you as, well, you're coming in as an entry-level person now, but aren't you in the long run going to be dissatisfied with that and kind of want my job?
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New York Times workologist columnist Rob Walker. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Rob, is there anything wrong with rolling the first 15 or 20 years of your work life off your resume?
This has come up a number of times, and there are different opinions about it. I sort of have come down on the side that it's maybe you don't want to eliminate everything completely, but it's really fair to just crunch that stuff down into something sort of vague, because people are, you know, this relates to the age question. People ask all the time, like, do I need to say what year I graduated from college and things like this, because they think that that'll be some kind of red flag. I think that as long as you don't put anything false on your resume, if you leave something off because of some nefarious reason, but just leaving things off, like maybe it's not relevant what you did 20 years ago, maybe it's not relevant to this job, and you can just sort of have a section at the end that said, you know, prior experience includes stints at whatever, happy to provide details. I think people get a little caught up in like the rigid formats of feeling like a resume is something where you have to fill in every single blank, and I don't know that that's always the case. The really important thing that to be on your resume is a clear articulation of the skills that you're offering and, their relevance to whatever the position is that you're seeking.
All right, let's speak now with Harry in Plano on the phone. Hi, Harry.
Good afternoon, guys. Boy, you're crisscrossing a lot of good elements here today. Part of my call to try to make it concise, I'm 63 now. My sons are 25 and 27. So I'm about 40 years apart as far as my grad year and employment, you know, work history versus theirs. I'm now retired. But I have been with one of the major oils, my background, two, 3 years, public affairs, and then my career went through HR for the rest of the way, EEO for 4 years, and then the risk compensation building up to doing executive comp and covering salary surveys within the industry, plus then compensation jobs cover across many disciplines. So it's not just oil against oil. It's IT all the way across other industries.
Harry, I'm just going to speed you up a little because we just have a little. I want to make sure that Rob has time to answer your question.
Here's where my point is. Trying to, as a parent at this stage, understand the millennials' dilemma, because when my two boys are looking for jobs, trying to work with the mindset of, well, I want to live here versus going where the job is, or I have to submit resumes computer-wise and online, and I'm not to call, or I violate rules, and so on and so forth. Could you please contrast the culture of the job search, the networking, or the focus, the mindset? What is the, I mean, I know stereotyping, but...
What's different today, I think, is what Harry's getting to, Rob.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, the answer is both, you know, has both to do with different generational attitudes, but also different realities of, you know, a lot of the job stuff, a lot of job searching is done in a computerized way now. Now, what you want them to do is make sure that they don't fall into a trap of that's the easy way to do things, because I can pretty much guarantee that what hasn't changed is that those personal connections and personally impressing someone are the things that are going to get you the job that you want. And that there is no way to shortcut that. You do have to make some sacrifices early in your career. And this is just very trite, but, you know, you have to remind them that, like, you may not get the exact job you want right away. It's the beginning of your career. Pick up new skills. Don't worry about that so much. Get in the workplace. Learn things. You don't really know what you want to do with your life anyway. So get out there and get started and take it from there.
Rob, we're all the star of our own movies. How do we know if we might be the problem at work and not everybody else around us?
Yeah, a great question, and something that I try to encourage people to do in a gentle way, and that is examine, be open to that possibility. It's another situation where trying to find an actual dispassionate person who's not directly involved in your workplace and doesn't have a grudge against either side, and kind of run things by them and really think hard about what, you know, this is the flip side of being empathetic and thinking about how someone else might see the situation. Because I don't know how many things I get where someone will say, this person is attacking me in meetings because of X, Y, you know, and she's just being totally unfair. And it's all just because I mentioned her in a confidential memo behind her back. It's like, well, you know, she's probably pretty mad about that.
Right.
And you have to sort of be open to how the other person sees it. And yeah, she's going to be mean to you in meetings, probably for the foreseeable future. So, you know, it depends on the questioner, but let's just say it's a recurring theme that comes up where you read some of these letters and you say, well, I totally see why you're having problems with your colleagues.
Rob Walker writes the workplace advice column, The Workologist, for the New York Times. You can find a link to that at think.kera.org. Rob, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks so much. It was a lot of fun.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.